What you're about to hear is unsupervised.
Welcome back to Unsupervised, a Stanley Cup of Chatter podcast. This is Season 2, Episode 10. I'm your host, Colin Beswick. Joined tonight as we record by Stanley Cup of Chatter editor, Sky. Sky, how you doing?
I'm doing great. I am very, very happy with the way my day has gone, and I'm ready to talk about hockey.
All right, you're bringing the positivity of the podcast tonight. I like it. I'll bring the negativity. It'll be a nice balance. We're also joined by... I guess we can call him a regular at this point by Stanley Cup of Chowder, staff writer and contributor, Sean Ferris. Sean, how you doing?
I'm doing all right, Colin.
Glad to hear it. I'm sure we'll get into some arguments along the way here. Anyone who follows us on Twitter or is in our Slack chat knows Sean and I love to argue back and forth. We do have a full docket tonight. It's been a little longer than normal in between episodes for us with the Super Bowl and with our schedules. We haven't had a chance to record as much as we'd like. So we're going to go kind of piecemeal and just run through a bunch of different stuff tonight. So it won't be as organized as usual, but wanted to hit on a bunch of topics. We'll start with maybe the heaviest hitter of the topics we have lined up in the question of the hour being, what would you do if you're Don Sweeney and Cam Neely by trade deadline? Everyone has their thoughts on this. Do you sell? Do you buy? Do you stay put at a high level? Do either of you feel strongly one way or the other?
Sean, you probably would want to go first because I'm still trying to think about what I would do in that case. It's very hinging.
Well, I mean, it's tough to say what you would do because you don't know what the market really is for players, right? I mean, you kind of get like the insight from the insiders, but you don't know everything and you don't know what's going on with talks between GMs and whatnot. So there's like, there's a lot of factors, but I made a point to Colin last night that this is probably the Bruins still have like a 2 to 3 year window, I would say, of like they could seriously compete. And you know, because then eventually Bergeron will decline. Same with Krejci, but like the next 2-3 years are definitely like the window for the Bruins. And with the goaltending this year, Yaro obviously having a terrific start, not as great as of late. Tuukka's been terrific as of late, didn't have a good start. So like that was nice having that balance there. But this is probably the best that goaltending's going to be in that 2 to 3 years. I mean, so I think if you think about it, goaltending in a way wins championships, right? You need to kind of get a little bit lucky, and goaltending's the best way to get lucky. So this might be their best window in the next 2-3 years, unless Sweeney works a little bit of magic. So personally, I'm more conservative on it. I like see like the long picture. I'm not a huge fan of making these short-term deadline moves, but it costs a lot of money. It costs a lot of assets to win, whether those are roster players, prospects, picks. So I can see the argument behind making moves. It's just going to be really tough to get somebody like Panarin. I don't think Stone's quite on the trading block. So that's why I kind of said like you don't necessarily know what's going on inside. Duchesne's probably another player that Ottawa's going to try to keep. We'll see. You know, but those are like the two big names outside of Panarin. And then they've also been like linked to Ryan Dzingo, which I like the idea of. I'm not sure what the price is on him. So I guess you really don't know.
Yeah, I completely agree. The market has really been held up by, I think the most interesting trade that happened today was the Brian Boyle trade. And that wasn't really all that substantial. It really feels like a lot of this window has been held up by the Senators deciding that they want to figure out something for guys like Mark Stone and Matt Duchesne, but they can't get it done, at least within a reasonable time frame. And because of that, I just don't feel like, I feel like everyone's just on edge waiting for the market to be set. And in general, I think if you wanted to buy this year, you'd have to go cheap. And you'd have to say one of the biggest issues of the year has been wing. but we're going to put that off, or we're going to draft well, hopefully, and we're going to figure it out. hopefully.
There's that optimism. You're bringing the optimism. I like it.
I'm bringing the best case scenario to you, is you say, we're going to cut our losses on that one thing, and we're going to attack a bigger issue like third line center or a depth player that costs probably less than $2 million. And if you can do that without giving up a major prospect, perfect. But right now, it's way too early to tell. And that's crazy considering we have, like, I don't know, was it 19 days until the deadline?
Yeah, about that. Yep.
It's 19 days to the deadline, and we still don't know what the market looks like. And that, to me, is what's going to make this a weird deadline, because any number of things could happen, or they could stand pat. And frankly, I don't know if that wouldn't be the worst idea, because, you know, a lot of the teams that should be selling are trying to do stupid things, objectively unintelligent things, like re-sign all these players who are never going to go anywhere with them. And I just don't know what they're going for here. Or even worse, they're trying to put this off until free agency, which helps nobody. So right now, if you really think you've got a guy that can fix one problem but not mask another maybe, then sure, go for it. Try and get them like a Michael Ferlin type, something like that. But look, it was a name. It is a name. If you can pick up one guy, that's fine. That's probably better than a lot of teams are going to do this year. But other than that, I don't know. I'm very concerned about the lack of a clear market right now. And that kind of gives me the impression that something really dumb is about to happen, or the market is just going to, or there's just going to be too much being thrown around by next week or the week after that Boston can be part of it. So
I don't worry about the market not being set yet. I think it'll heat up as we get closer. But I mean, I guess my rebuttal or my follow-up to that is, do you think that one piece is enough to really move the scale enough for this team?
Oh, hell no. Hell right no, now? Absolutely that, not.
That's sort of how I feel. Unless that piece is like Mark Stone or, you know, someone of that caliber. And even then, okay, so you have two lines now. You have the Berge line and, you know, the Krejci and Stone or Krejci and Panarin line.
So and that's huge. More with less?
Yeah, it's huge. And, you know, if your goaltending holds, like Sean said, that's great. You still have two fourth lines if you're lucky. And you look at a team like Tampa Bay, who I know, you know, every year there's that team that looks like an absolute wagon. And, you know, we think they're going to march right to the Stanley Cup, and they don't. But, I mean, I look at Tampa and I think, I mean, they're head and shoulders above where the Bruins are currently. And they're not the only team that I think are significantly better than the Bruins. And again, it's on paper. I get that. But I don't think one move, even a major one, is enough to appreciably change their odds of actually winning a Stanley Cup enough for the cost it's going to take to get a Panarin or a Stone or a Tarasenko or whatever the name of the day is around here.
Yeah, it feels like this entire trade deadline season is just preview to an inevitable really, really crazy free agency period come this summer, which is interesting, but it kind of hamstrings you in a way where you know that you have too many problems, you know you have too many holes to fill, to the point where I don't think you can get it done in one deadline season without completely coring your depth. And that's a real tight bind to be in right now.
Yeah, and I'm obviously one of the more vocal critics of Don Sweeney, and I guess to some extent Cam Neely, for whatever his role in the day-to-day hockey operations is at this point in time. But yeah, they're not in an easy spot. I don't think there's a right answer one way or the other, and that's a pretty rare statement coming from me. I normally feel like I know one way or the other what I think they should do. In this case, I'm not sure. Like I said, I don't think that they're one piece away necessarily, but I also can respect the argument that, you know, the Bergeron window, if that's what we're calling it, is it's not closed, but it's starting to close. The Chara window is pretty much gone, I think, at this point. I don't know if he'll be back next year. And I'm not necessarily going all out to win him a cup, as much as we all, you know, respect him and all of that. You know, if they don't win in his last year here, they still can win it with Krejci and Bergeron and Marchand and the rest of the core. So I don't know. I don't think they're in an easy position. But I also think the position they're in is almost entirely their fault. So you won't get any sympathy from me here. I think they did a poor job of constructing this roster in the offseason, and I don't think it's gotten any better. And now they're forced to either overpay for someone like a Michael Ferland or whoever it may be, and it still won't be enough to really swing the odds. I mean, they paid a boatload for Rick Nash last year. Everyone knows my feelings on that. And even if he'd been healthy, I don't think that would have made enough of a difference. So tough to feel like trying that over with a different player this year is going to make a huge difference.
You never know. You never know. But it's still a very, very tight window that they're in to actually make some kind of move. And that's making, and again, the uncertainty in this market is just making this deadline season so much harder, because you don't even know what moves you can make right now, because for all we know, tomorrow all the big names could be re-signed and they all say, I've always wanted to be here, I just wanted the money. So who knows where this goes. It's gonna be fun though.
Yeah, that's the joy of deadline season, I guess, or the anguish, depending on what side what side you're on. But like
the joyquish.
Yeah, joyquish. I mean, we'll see. Like you said, I personally don't consider them contenders, and unless they make some serious moves, I don't see that changing. But on the flip side, I don't want them trading away the Stednikos or the Vakaninens or whatever of the world, unless they're really truly making, you know, moves that are going to catapult them ahead of where they are. So we'll see. All I know is that hopefully or probably won't be as bad as anything Shirelli's done in the last few years. So, you know, we have that to look forward to. Sweeney is at least not Shirelli, who finally got the boot in Edmonton. A couple years too late there. I had a whole rant I wanted to go on Shirelli. I'll save everyone the Peter Shirelli rant on this episode. But I did want to dive into another topic that sort of came about because I was ranting a little bit on Twitter, to nobody's surprise. And that's about, you know, what to think about Zdeno Chara, or how we should evaluate Zdeno Chara at this point in his illustrious and long career. And if you've been on Bruins Twitter long enough, you've seen the comments just like about Rask or Krejci or any other, you know, divisive figure. There are plenty of Bruins fans out there who think Chara should retire, or he's not effective, or whatever the case may be. And I usually ignore them, but it gets a little harder to ignore when you have Bruce Cassidy publicly calling out Chara, you know, last week, sort of blaming him for the defensive lapses that other players were making. Didn't sit right with me, even if the results seem to work in the last couple of wins they've had here. I'm curious, one of you, what your thoughts on Bruce's method of sort of calling out Chara for other people's mistakes are, and as a follow-up, how you feel about his level of play this year at 41 years old.
Sean first. He's been writing all over the place.
I was there. I was in that press conference. Okay. So, I mean, I guess I have that. No, but, I mean, I don't know. That might have been – I think it's more something like overlook. Like, I think that might have just been – Bruce's guy to kind of call out. Like, he knows that Chara can take it when he's trying to just kind of call out the Bruins. That was after the Flyers game. The Bruins gave up a few odd man rushes that game, and Chara was on the ice for the only one against that turned into a goal. And I mean, he looked flat out, he looked ugly on that play, but I mean, it wasn't necessarily his fault. It was a shot that got blocked by Andrew McDonald, or it went off his stick and Flyers took it the other way. There was two Flyers in the neutral zone and there's no way Chara was going to stop anything. So I think that was more or less something that Bruce kind of just used as like, that's a guy who he can use to call out without hurting his feelings kind of thing. But I don't know. I mean, Chara's still an effective player. Look, he's not what he used to be, you know, but he's still an effective player. He has good, you know, results against top lines still. So, I mean, for being, what's he, 41 now?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he is 41.
And he gets extensively matched up against, you know, the top lines of the opposing teams, and I think he fares pretty well. The Bruins give up less quality shots when he's on the ice and against the, you know, opponent's top players. So he's still effective. And I think that was more or less just Bruce trying to call everybody out. I mean, they were on a losing skid. They lost, was it 5-6? And, you know, he just, that was just his guy to call out. I didn't look into that too much.
That's fair. I mean, he is the captain. I get that on some level, you know, you call it your leaders because they can take it sort of deal. But it wasn't just the press conference, too. I know you covered for us that night. I was at home on that game watching, and Bruce said it a couple of different times, and he wasn't really holding back. He said it to Jack and Brick in the post game. He said it in the press conference to the media. Said it like three different ways, and he really wasn't, like said, holding back. And I get what he's doing, but I think that it often was misinterpreted by others to be a direct attack on Chara specifically, when in reality, even though that's what it sounded like, I don't think that's what Bruce is really trying to do. Said Moore had the arguably the most egregious, you know, play there when, like you said, where, you know, he shot from the point, it turns into an odd man rush. But it's interesting because it feeds that fire with that segment of the fan base that has wanted Chara gone seemingly for years, or stripped of the captaincy, or whatever the stupid take of the day is. But I mean, what did you think, Sky? Does it sit okay with you? Do you still think Chara is effective, even though he's 110 years old?
155, actually.
Forgot the round.
I think he's. I think that Chara is pretty effective. He's still able to face the Sidney Crosbys and Connor McDavids of this league and still come out relatively on top. He's still got a reach that he knows exactly how to use. He's still one of the better penalty killers on the team, even if age has taken some of that away. And he's able to do effective board play, which is also very important for a defenseman. One thing I do think is that about the comments. One thing that I did take a lot from that was in there somewhere, he says that Chara needs to get the young guys to buy in. And I don't think that just means, you know, the young blue liners and the back checkers as a core. I think that just means the whole team, especially these young players that have been in, that have just recently entered the team. He really wants Chara to like step up, you know, show leadership and say, guys, this is how we do things. We've got to be more responsible with the puck, that sort of thing. Granted, you know, they had gone through some really, really ugly losses throughout that entire stretch where it seemed like him and Charlie McAvoy could do nothing right. And at least in terms of eye test, because other than that, they were doing okay. And I think it's just randomness being interpreted as a slip in play, which, you know, it happens throughout the season. So as far as I'm concerned, they'll pick themselves back up. They'll play LA twice in the next week, so they'll probably be way better than they were. So I think this will be a good test this February to see, once you play all these disastrous teams, plus I guess like San Jose twice, and you can really put those guys back into a better groove than they've been. So I don't know. I think the idea of like, we got to get rid of them now, that's months ahead. That's, you still got 3-4 months of hockey left and then playoffs. Whatever happens after that, whatever injury he picks up, that's when you start talking. That's when you start deciding whether or not he's good enough to take back.
So I have lots of thoughts on this, and definitely get what you're saying in terms of, like, you know, not necessarily just the defenseman, but sort of the team as a whole and the younger players. But I guess from where I'm sitting, calling out Chara of all people for a lack of leadership is sort of an odd move. And I made those comments on Twitter because I think
it is an odd move, but I think in order to get those young guys' attention, he called out the scariest human being on the ice. And that's important. That's very, very important in my opinion, because not only is he going to be able to, you know, bring this up with at practice, he's going to have another far more intimidating human being bring it up. It's weird to do. It's very weird to do. And I don't think it, worked as well as he thinks it probably should have. But other than that, I think it's more a generalized comment about the team's defense disguised as Chara call out. That said, I totally understand your frustration if fans believe that was the last straw and they're all in on trying to, if they're trying to get Chara out of town, that sort of thing. That is very frustrating. That's not what they're trying to do. They're just trying to refocus these guys as hard as they can. And if that means having a 6'9" Slovakian giant chase them around, so be it.
Yeah, I agree. I,
if it works, it works.
I think we agree on what Bruce was trying to do. And, you know, it's a small segment of the fan base that you know, sort of hates on Chara, of course. Same with Tuukka and same with Krejci and Krug and all the other, you know, divisive players. But I guess I'll say the same thing about this situation that I've said sort of all year, is that when we see Bruce get frustrated, which is a fairly rare occasion, he normally doesn't get too frustrated publicly. I guess my takeaway is that instead of, you know, scapegoating for better or worse Chara or, you know, whoever it may be, you know, it might just be that the roster isn't that good. I know it's a hot take, but like, it seems like half the team is underperforming. And I know we can't come out and say like, yo, Sweeney, do your job. Get me some players.
That's not his fault.
But it is exactly like you said earlier that, you know, fans will misinterpret what he's kind of saying without saying there and take it as a direct shot, you know, on Chara. And it does, it just feeds those fires. My thing with Chara, like at a high level, is that what Sean said is that he's not what he was. He hasn't been what he was for 2 or 3 or 4 years, but he's maintained a fairly steady, you know, level of performance over the last 3 or 4 years, especially for his age. And I think this year is the first year where we're really starting to see, you know, not slipping, but, you know, I guess regression or whatever you want to call it. You know, he's not the Char that we're used to, and that's fine. He's playing the lowest minutes of his entire career outside of his rookie season, and like by far, it's not even close. He's playing under 21 minutes a night. He played 23 the last two seasons, 24 before that, 23, 24, you know, going up into the 20, almost 28 in, you know, mid-career. So they've been smart about managing his minutes. They're using him as a shutdown pair, like, you know, Sean and you both mentioned. But my issue is with fans who still expect him to be, you know, preeminent, Norris Trophy winning, best of his generation defenseman. He's not that. He hasn't been that. And I don't know why we have to tell certain fans to adjust their expectations for a guy who's literally 41 years old. But if you're listening, fans, this is for you. He's 41. He's not that guy anymore. But he's still a perfectly fine everyday NHL defenseman, second pair guy. Whether he'll keep that up for another year or two, I don't know. But this year, you know, there's nothing wrong with him being out there. You just notice his mistakes because he's 100 feet tall and he's slow. It happens.
I mean, I understand in theory the idea behind it, and it's a weird sociological thing I want to look more into, but I think there's an expectation of like immediate success or eminent success that is just constant. And when star players or players that are name brands in the city of Boston struggle, people talk about it, and it's not always positively. If you at all ever, God forbid, turn on the radio and hear anything about any baseball player of the past, oh, I don't know, 2 decades.
The trick is to not turn on the radio.
Yes, but I am an idiot, and I frequently make this mistake over and over. But we have an uninflated sense of expectations here in Boston because we win everything every other year, with the exception of maybe one or two teams, and then when people pay attention, they go, what the hell's going on? Why haven't all these big turnover things that I'm used to in other sports happened here? Which I think is a big part of it, is when players get old in other sports, they just disappear. And in hockey, that just doesn't happen at all. And so the amount of commitment that is added into hockey is kind of, I don't want to say anathema, but it's unusual for Boston sports, where there's plenty of turnover, you know, every 1 to 5 years. So I think it's just people have to be conditioned back into the flow of hockey and understanding that, you know, contracts are contracts are contracts, and no move clauses are no move clauses.
No way.
And they can't be changed.
Once more for those in the back.
Because you don't like them.
David Backes just, is not getting traded.
As much as we'd love that to happen. It's just, the game is different. The game has been different. And you got to adjust your expectations, like, substantially. But otherwise, right now, now that you're kind of out of this losing skid, I think he did okay against New York. I think he did perfectly fine against New York. So who knows? Maybe the other New York team will make him look even better.
I wanted to stick with defensemen, you know, just for a quick bit here, because there was some comments that I don't know if controversial is the right word, but I think there were a lot of place by, you know, one of the media members here that was comparing McAvoy to Grizzlick and their development, and basically, you know, saying that Grizz was significantly more ahead of McAvoy in their development, which, like, all due respect, Grizz is 4+ years older and, you know, didn't have heart issues and various other, you
also
know,
wasn't concussed this
yeah,
year.
It's just it's a terrible comparison. And, you know, yes, respectfully or not respectfully, it's a bad comparison. That's my take on it. But I'm curious sort of on what both of you think about McAvoy, because he's been sort of the target for a lot of criticism. And I don't think all of it's unfair, to be clear. I don't think that he has progressed as much as we like or want him to. And it's sort of a perfect segue from what you were saying, Sky, and that Boston fans sort of want what they want, and they want it right away because we're used to it. But those of us who've been fans long enough, I guess maybe not Sean, but who've been around for a lot of the players who've been run out of town, I worry about that with McAvoy. We're already starting to see media members sort of, you know, take little pot shots here and there at him for not being, you know, like a top young defenseman right away. I don't know if that's fair. I guess it's a matter of expectations, but I think they look at him, he's 21. He said he had heart issues, which is no joke. Obviously, you know, you want to take that seriously. He's had other injuries. Do you think he's progressing along sort of where you each expected he would be, or is he behind, ahead? Do you have thoughts on that?
Scott, you go first. Give me a second.
All right. I think had he not been concussed this season, which is something no one can account for, I'm sure he'd probably be going through some of the same problems. I think in general, he's been fine. He has had some boneheaded things he's occasionally done. He's occasionally passed directly to the other team, which will get any fan unhappy. But that's also happened with players who should be done. You know, guys like John Moore have had that happen. And
sorry.
But it's happened before my eyes, and I, to this day, cannot tell you what he was trying to do. The thing is, you know, these are the bumps that you go through in development, especially when you're trying to develop them in the NHL instead of, you know, letting them take their lumps in the AHL, or, you know, because you know they're way too good for the AHL. I think it's sophomore slump sort of deal. He's not going to be, you know, the be-all, end-all replacement yet, but he has that potential. And you don't just give up on a player because he's going through struggles. You have to grit your teeth, say, okay, this is the best thing for him right now, and say, God, I wish he'd get it over it. But sometimes that means you have to go through a whole 82 games. So,
like, I don't even think he's been that bad, to be clear. Like, I don't think he's been really bad at all. It's just a bad in terms of what the expectations were from some people, perhaps. But, like, and not to jump in front of Sean here, we'll get his comments, but, like, this is the same fan base and I guess media base who wanted to trade away Carlo every 3 seconds, you know, a year or two ago, because they didn't think that he was going to amount to anything, and his ceiling was lower than they expected, and so on and so forth. And then in his third season, we're seeing how much he's sort of blossomed and grown into, and he's never going to be a number one defenseman, but he's been an excellent shutdown defenseman. Is, you know, he's making better reads, better decisions. You know, he's been maybe, you know, Krug's probably their best defenseman at this point, but he's close. And so, like, I listened to the McAvoy, you know, chirping and all that stuff, and it's like, do we not learn from every other young player we've watched come through here? So I don't know. That, I think that's just sort of, I want to dive in. But Sean, what did you think about all this?
I think you were about to say it, but I think he's been the best defenseman so far this season. Carlo's been the most dependable, but I mean, based on everything, so he's by far, he scored more than any other defenseman at 5-on-5 for the Bruins, like by a long shot. So his distance, he is, and it's a little bit different because he has much smaller sample size, right? But he is 1.16 points per 60, and the next best is Torrey Krug at 0.78, which is the gap from Krug to Kevin Miller, right? So it's a huge gap. Part of that is because of the sample size. But, I mean, looking either the Evolving Wild Twins, he comes out to the top of their expected goals, regression adjusted plus minus. Micah McCurdy's on-ice threat, which is like an expected – it's a expected goals model. It's like shots weighted by the location that they're taken. He's by far the best offensive defenseman at plus 8%. Better than league average, while also being good defensively, being 13% better than league average. And when he's off the ice, the Bruins are 3% below league average offensively and 8% above league average defensively. So, and he's also done that by facing, you know, the top competition too. So, I mean, I think McAvoy's been terrific and really everything you kind of hope for. And I don't understand where a lot of the criticism comes from, except he recently saw a huge rise in, or I guess a huge drop in his on-ice save percentage, which is probably where it's come from, and a huge drop in his on-ice shooting percentage. So, like, the tides have kind of flipped for him in terms of luck, while he's consistently outshot opponents. And we're also talking about the best opponents too, right? Because he plays top against the top lines. So I don't know. I think he's been terrific.
I think you're giving too much credit to like the people who are being overly critical.
I'm pretty sure it's just eye test. Like, he has occasionally thrown just the most insane pass that doesn't go anywhere and only serves to make him look bad. But, you know, that's once out of 60 minutes of hockey. Like, otherwise, he's been perfectly fine, I think. I just think it's some rookie jitters, and he'll get over it next year, and he'll be way better than he's looked, and then he'll probably be even better, at least when the fancy stats tabulate it.
He just needs to score a sweet shootout goal and everything will be forgiven by the fan base for another couple months, I think.
Absolutely. But,
like, I guess the takeaway from all three of us here, it sounds like we're more or less in agreement, is that, one, he's not nearly as bad or even bad, really. And that, like every other seemingly talented young player that's come through the Bruins pipeline in my lifetime of watching them, you know, and I'll include myself, we are often too harsh on them too soon, you know, just because they find success, you know, quicker than we may have expected doesn't mean that they're going to sustain that or improve at a linear rate that, you know, fans sometimes think they are. That's all also, like, you know, microcosm of why it's important to go beyond eye test and really see what the results are when they're on and off the ice and all of that as well. And I know not everyone's going to do that. It's just a fact, but you know, that is sort of why it's important around here. So I think he's fine. I think fans should be patient and, like I said, do a little more research on him. And I'm not even sure how much is fan driven in this case. I think a lot of it's media driven. And
don't trust your eyes. Don't trust your eyes. Your eyes can be easily fooled.
Yeah, even I mean, there's no doubt. Like the best scouts shouldn't trust their eyes all the time either. You know, like you could be a vaunted member of the 200 hockey men and legitimately know more about hockey than the rest of us combined. Your eyes still aren't going to absorb all the information that you need to. That's the purpose of statistics. And I know people hate that take, but it's true. Like there's no way around it. So
he also like, he's the most dynamic defenseman for the Bruins. Like, so yeah, we'll go with the game against the Flyers, and I don't remember if Chara was on the ice, but you know, the Flyers are playing man-on-man coverage and Krejci's coming from the high left boards and he's coming down. So there's an obvious hole that's going to open up, and McAvoy sees that hole, and Scott Laughton, who's been one of the few decent defensive forwards, if I remember correctly, for the Flyers, got to stick in the passing lane, and they had like an on-band rush the other way. But those are risks that, especially when you have by far the lowest shooting percentage in the league and you can't score goals, those are risks that you need to be able to take. And I mean, Cassidy also said something that I find really backwards is like, our identity right now is team defense, and until we can score goals, we have to focus on that, which is like it's backwards thinking. Like, yeah, you need to be able to take the risk to score the goals, and then you don't have to rely on the defense because you just lost a 3-2 game where you only allowed one 5-on-5 goal, and then you lost, you know, against one. I mean, we can go on and on about, you know, the low scoring games that they've lost. So, I mean, I think his mistakes, because he takes risks, you know, they're like more glorified, or it's easier to see. And especially like with people that are kind of behind where the game is headed, or I shouldn't say that because that sounds like support, but like are still back in like the 1930s, you know, like the game is different now. And, you know, you see teams take risks and it works out. Like if you watch a Tampa Bay Lightning game, they are going to take risks in the offensive zone. They're a terrific forechecking team because they apply pressure so heavily. Or Pittsburgh with their two Stanley Cups were known as like an extremely aggressive team that ran a 2-on-2 forecheck. You know, so I think his mistakes are just more obvious, and that probably is what gets him eaten up. And then, I mean, there was talk about like locker room stuff going on. I don't know. It seems like any good young defenseman gets run out of town, whether it's Dougie Hamilton, Colin Miller, you know, whatever it might be. Yeah. So it's just another defenseman coming and hopefully not going.
Yeah, a couple quick hitters on that, and I won't go too deep for all of our sakes and not to cause any issues here, but one, the comments you mentioned being backwards by Cassidy, I think if we're reading between the lines, that was the perfect example of him wanting to say, like, hey, Sweeney, get me better players, but he can't, so he reverts to saying, well, we have to be a good defensive team because we can't score to save our, you know, our bleeping lives right now. And it's true, they can't, but you're right that the thinking is backward. But I've seen enough of Bruce to think that I don't know that he really buys into that, even though he said it. The other thing too, is you mentioned like, you know, the whispers about locker room issues and all of that. And I don't know if I can say this nicely, but I'll try. People really need to be careful about how much they're buying into stuff they see online or they're hearing from a third or fourth party or whatever about that. You'd think,
or from a podcast.
Yeah. Including us. Like that, you know, vet sources. And I understand fans aren't journalists or anything like that, but like, you know, I heard the whispers, I had people reach out to me, I had stuff like that, but just because people are saying that doesn't mean it's true, you know. And I'm not an insider, I don't pretend to be by any stretch of the imagination, but like if you've been a fan long enough, and I know some of our listeners are older than I am, as crazy as that is, like, this happens all the time. Like, it, just because someone's saying it does not mean it's true. And, you know, his teammates came out and immediately, you know, just stomped that fire out. Just, I don't know, I guess I'm saying here, like, even if they have a blue check mark or not, it doesn't mean that what they're saying is necessarily true. So just, you know, take everything with a grain of salt, including some of the dumb stuff I probably say. I don't know. But that's it on McAvoy. Like I said, I think we need to be more patient and understand that the occasional mistake doesn't, you know, erase all the good stuff he does when he's on the ice. We'll switch gears a little bit here. You know, we sort of went heavy on the defense. Little lighthearted, I guess, but the Patriots, you know, just won their millionth Super Bowl in the last, you know, 10, 15 years here. We're definitely spoiled here. You know, we poke fun, of course, about, you know, other cities and everything, but it is great to be able to watch, you know, championships here, whether it's been the Red Sox or the Patriots or even the Celtics going back. But
or even what passed for football on Sunday.
Yeah, that was, I don't care what anyone says, that was not entertaining. Fight me.
It was, I think it was entertaining for everyone's dad who played like
offensive
fullback
line
in high school. Yeah, offensive line or fullback.
Defense. Yeah, like
low scoring, running the ball.
Like
that sort of thing.
I'll listen to someone's take that it was a good game, that's fine. But if you're trying to tell me it was entertaining, to each their own. I don't really enjoy watching punts every 6 minutes, but what I wanted to get at,
Iowa State football is not for you.
I do enjoy football, but you know, everyone's offensively inclined these days. But I did want to say, and you know, we're probably not the first to think of this, but just quickly, who out of the four major Bruins sports team or Boston sports teams do you think is most likely to win a championship next?
I'm going to put five, and I say Boston Pride, because they're actually very good. And it's very hard to say, looking, just watching them, having gone to a game and watching them play, I don't know how anyone's going to beat them, because they're just, it's not just that they're talented, it's that they're all in sync, and they all know exactly what they're going to do, and they know their strategy like it's like back of their hand. Really, the only thing that they can just hope for is that Bird heats up and it'll be smooth sailing. They'll probably have a great time in the Isabel Cup playoffs. And I bet you they're going to bring home a championship. We might have to go all the way to, I don't know, June. I know. For some of you younger fans, it's tough. Please stay with me. Another championship will come.
Yeah, I don't know if we can make it that long. That's rough. And I did like some of the you know, current and former Pride players throwing a little bit of shade at various outlets or whoever about not including the Pride's championship in sort of the roundup of Bruins championships over the last couple of decades. And that's definitely a good call with the Pride. So we all caught a game. If you didn't see that the other day, I highly recommend checking it out. Tickets are affordable. It's at Warrior Arena.
They don't check anything at the door, by the way.
People are going to misinterpret that.
No.
But it's a good time, and they deserve your support. So definitely get a chance to check that out.
Absolutely.
For me, I if you take the timing of when seasons are played out of it, I guess I'd go with the Patriots again, just because I think, like, on a probability, they're the most likely, they're the most dominant of the four major teams, at least. But I think both the Celtics and the Red Sox are legitimate contenders as well, so it's sort of a cop-out, but I could see either of them. The one that I don't think is, unfortunately for all of us, is the Bruins. I don't see them winning this year, at least. And Sean, I don't know if you watch all the sports. I know you're not a Pats fan, boo. But did you have a particular team you think is closest?
I don't know. I haven't been following the NBA quite as much as I probably should, because that's such an entertaining league. But from what I'm gathering with people like talking about it in group chats, hasn't been going well for the Celtics. Not necessarily record-wise, but like they need a couple pieces and they're not going to get them. So I guess we'll take the Celtics out. I mean, I really like the Red Sox chances this year. I mean, hockey is so random. You just don't know if the Bruins have a legitimate chance. They don't seem to right now, but like they could. But I don't know. I'm gonna go with Red Sox with the repeat.
Like I said,
I like that.
Yep, same. I think they have a legitimate chance. I mean, like I said, with the Patriots, they've just been so dominant. It seems that they're the most likely.
I'm like, God, it would just piss off so many people.
Oh, I'm sure.
I so want that. I just love. It has become my favorite thing on the internet. Is everyone, especially on main site, just going, "Ugh, Boston is so good at sports. It makes me mad."
Yeah,
it's my favorite part of the whole experience.
It's a double-edged sword for me because I'm weird. Everyone knows that, but like, I really, really care about like trying to be objective about things to the point where I honestly annoy the crap out of a lot of people. I get that, but like, I enjoy the sort of whining and ranting about the Patriots, but I also like legitimately hate all of the like straw men and like ridiculous cheating comments and all that stuff by people who don't even understand like Spygate or anything.
Yeah, well, then my answer to that is they have a better team.
Yeah, I mean, like, we
have a better AFC. That's the answer to this question.
We get that, but you see otherwise, like, really intelligent and objective people just, like, totally melt down when it comes to the Patriots. Like, they just can't handle it. They hate them. And, like, so that's entertaining.
So good.
Entertaining on some level, but sometimes it can be a little much. I don't know. That's just my take.
Hook it to my veins. Hook that hate to my veins.
But, I mean, like I said, I could see literally any of them, even the Bruins, to Sean's point. You know, we all know hockey is pretty random. And even though I think we all agree that they're currently not really a contender, that doesn't mean they couldn't go out and win the cup this year. They very, very well could.
Maybe Solaric just loses his mind in the playoffs and plays lights out.
Yeah.
Maybe he just scores every game.
Yeah, free celery, baby.
Look at the Islanders. I mean, They should be where they are. And look at them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. I mean, anything's possible with hockey. It's kind of why we watch it. So.
Oh, hell yeah. I'm totally for whatever crazy nonsense happens towards the end of this season that gets, I don't know who, into the playoffs or desperate or not.
That's
the best part of the game.
That's literally partly why, I mean, hockey's the best sport in the world anyways, but that's partly why I enjoy it so much, even when it's not the Bruins, is that I really enjoy it's not the same team necessarily every year. It's not Golden State Warriors. You know, I like that, you know, it's almost a flip of a coin even between, you know, good teams or whatever. So that's always been appealing to me. I know not everyone feels that way, but it would be great to see the Bruins win another cup, you know, soon, or at least in my lifetime. I was in Iraq when they won. Their only one during my lifetime, so it would be great to get to a Bruins championship parade here. I want to on a quick hit on a couple of things that I have, we'll call them Collins criticisms about, mini rants here. The first is TD Garden is undergoing a pretty massive and probably overdue renovation to just about long everything. Overdue. Sky for sure knows that. He's at most of the games. And it's great. I'm glad they're getting better seats and all of that stuff. And there'll be cooler bars or whatever. You know, like, it's great, I guess.
There's going to be more. The way more important thing is that there's going to be places where these enemies of freedom go to stand out on the concourse and do nothing. Those people can go disappear into some hole somewhere, sit down, eat some food, I don't know, talk about whether or not they're going to be at Thanksgiving with each other, where they will, again, stand around in the hallway and do nothing. But that, more than anything, is the only thing I've wanted throughout my entire experience of being an STH, is just, if there's one thing I'd ever change, it's just move all those people to the back wall or get them the heck out of there. Because they're just clogging up an already clogged concourse. There's, you know, 17,000 people running around there. And you, the reprobate standing there are making it worse for everyone else. God.
Yeah, you have some strong feelings there.
If I knew which wall they were knocking down to make this happen, I'd come to the next game with a sledgehammer to help out.
I say,
Sir Oz, where do you need this to go?
I really have two rants that I thought of. One, I'd like cheaper beer, which is never going to happen. But, you know, on the off chance that I catch a game as a fan, don't love spending $14 for domestic or whatever. But my real rant, and one that I like seriously, TD Garden, Jacob's family, whoever, if you're listening, you got to get like some tall boy seats here for me, man. I'm 6'5", 260 pounds. Like I'm a big guy. And when I sit, you know, when I'm not in the press box, when I'm catching a game with my wife or as a fan or with Sky or like whatever, it literally hurts. Like my legs are so long that I get bruises on my shins and my knees, which I know is a first world problem catching a $300 Bruins game, but like it's bad, man. Like I'll pay more. It's like an airplane flight. Like, you know, everyone complains about that too, but you know, I'm that big that I really can't fit in the seats, and even sideways, and I'm throwing elbows at people next to me. And like, you already charge too much for it, you know, as it is, but I'll pay more, man. So I don't, you know, start bleeding from my kneecaps because I pressed into the seat in front of me and, you know, ruining that guy or that lady's time too. So that'd be cool if in the $100 million you're going to spend on this or whatever it is, you know, they put a couple big boy seats in there for guys my size. And I'm not the only one. So please, TD Garden, listen to us and also help Sky out and move these people to the back, for God's sake.
Or just remove them entirely. That would make my life.
Hey, they're paying customers, you know.
Yeah, and they can pay for the seats that they got.
Yeah, this I wasn't actually planning on talking about this, but this one just like blows my mind. And one of the big things that they're sort of like, you know, really pushing heavily here is the the Legends or Rafters Club or whatever.
Yes, and which
that's my project this semester.
Am I stealing your thunder here, Sean?
Well, hang on ahead. If he's got this thing, then I think Sean should discuss this.
No, I had to write like a 30-page marketing plan for Raptors. I mean, I chose it, but I was like, oh, yeah, I'm interested in this, so why not?
Middle school got a lot tougher since I graduated. That sounds like a lot of money.
But yeah, I'm gonna have to like. I was gonna say like we could rent out the Raptors studios for the game. I'm sure it'll only be like $200,000 a game. Yeah, it'll be all
corporate sponsor too. But
we can just ask. We can just ask SBN Maine to cover the bill.
Exactly, that's what I was thinking. Sure. That's a corporate.
Yeah, Vox Media to pay up. Sure.
Yeah.
I don't know. This is just like an opinion, like full opinion, not fact or anything. So take it for what it's worth. But all three of us are very intimately familiar with the press box. You know, we all cover games, all of that. And that's essentially where that new, like, you know, club or whatever we're calling it is going. They're adding like a row of seats on the, what is it, the seventh floor or ninth floor? I always get this wrong. You think I'd know?
It's the seventh.
I'm only there. Here you go.
The studios are on the ninth.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, you do not want to sit that high. I'm telling you this, like, as someone who covers games, they're
at the press box.
Yeah, no, it's not.
I like.
Oh, see, this is why I'm saying it's opinion. Everywhere.
For those of us who are not of a certain age, I'm sure it's very difficult to adjust your bifocals to see. But frankly, if you're going up there, I think that club is going to be there just for the rich to show up and say, "I went to a Bruins game." I don't think any of the people who go to those are going to give a rat's ass about whether or not they actually paid attention to the game.
I don't know. I went.
It's gonna have like a full fledged like private bar, and they're gonna have. Well, they said unique foods. I gotta figure out what that means.
And they're gonna get the free popcorn and pretzels from the press box. It's unique.
Well, the watermelon candy. The watermelon candy.
Hey, those are good. Those are good.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it's the equivalent of a luxury box in football.
But you're higher up. They already have the luxury boxes. They're just going up, you know, two floors or whatever.
They're not really luxury, are they? Like, I think
you have your own bartender. Yeah, they're pretty nice.
I don't know. They're trying to like sell the whole thing that you're up in the rafters with like all the Celtics and Bruins banners, which like I don't quite understand. Yep, that.
I'll send everyone a photo of it and see. It.
Calling it Raptor Studios.
Yeah, to each their own. Like I said, I think it'll be more corporate and you know like Richie Rich type stuff. But all I'm asking for is like a couple tall boy seats here and some cheaper beer. That's all I want. But yeah. Good for them. Like I said, TD Garden's long overdue. Maybe they'll fix the elevators, which is a very like niche press issue here. But
I would get down on my hands and knees and thank Jeremy Jacobs every day in prayer if he did that.
For those who like, if you've ever caught I caught a Bill Burr concert up in the press box once, and it was Bill Burr's awesome. But the seats are terrible. But the elevators are legitimately the slowest elevators I've ever been on anywhere in my entire life. Like, and you know, we're not here to complain about being pressed. We all enjoy what we do. It's great. But like, they're really bad. Like, we're not exaggerating this. It takes forever to get up and down. And you have to, obviously, to get to the locker rooms and all that too. So that would be great if they could update those. So we have a long wish list here of stuff that we would like to put on Jeremy's tab here. But I have one more quick rant in me that all of you in our Slack channel have already heard over and over and over again. But my boy Riley Nash, you know, I'm so sick of the Riley Nash only has 5 points in Columbus talk. Like, I feel like my brain starts bleeding every time someone says that to me. Like, oh, yeah, he wouldn't help. He has 5 points. Like, yeah, Riley Nash would still be your third best center on this team. And I will fight anyone who says that, not literally, our lawyers will jump in here. But like, just because he's not performing in a new city for, you know, a half season's worth of games does not mean that all of a sudden the Monstars stole all of his talent and he's just this husk of a player. We know what he is. We know what he would do in Boston because he already did it here in Boston. And like, there's this weird like lack of logic in people's brains where like they think he went to Columbus and he just like, he's dead. He's not a real player anymore. He sucks. Like, nah, he would still be good. And I didn't say they should re-sign him when he left. I literally wrote that they probably should not because of how much it would cost. But when they gave John Moore the same amount of money over 5 years versus 3 years for Riley Nash, like I 100% would rather have Riley Nash as your third line center this year over John Moore as your like seventh or eighth defenseman. So like, again, I will metaphorically fight anyone who wants to come at me with Riley Nash nonsense. He's my dude. And I don't care that he has 5 points in Columbus. He's playing for a madman.
Who could have possibly guessed that playing with Marcus Hanakainen and Lucas Sedlak might actually be detrimental to your performance? Who among us? And being coached by an actual crazy person.
Yeah, an actual madman. And not even playing center. They signed this guy for 3 years. And they're like, you're going to be a wing, left wing, right wing. Just, whatever. Like, oh, yeah, I wonder why he's not performing in a team that barely has any structure and a guy who's throwing chairs at you every 2 seconds. Like, I don't know. I'm probably being too defensive of Riley Nash here, but the point still stands. Like, he absolutely would be your third best center on his team, and it wouldn't make you a contender, but you'd be better off than you are right now. So that's my rant. Please stop coming at me, Twitter randos, with your terrible Riley Nash takes. They're awful. Just stop.
You feel better about yourself now?
A little bit. Yeah, it helps. Okay, it's cathartic to get it out there a little bit. You know.
Now the healing can begin.
Supporting my fellow redhead here. But we'll dive into hopefully probably one last topic here because we're already over the or about the hour mark here. But actually two, I wanted to touch on how you thought Solaric looks in his limited time, as well as Trent Frederick in his limited time. And then we'll go into, I think, what I think is a really interesting topic to close out in DeBrusk versus Heinen, which I've been sort of harping on Twitter a little bit. But to dive back into the Solaric and Frederick, I'm curious just like high-level evaluations of each, obviously different positions and different usage for sure. But I liked what I've seen out of Solaric so far and less so out of Trent Frederick, you know, his chuck and nucks notwithstanding there.
That sounds lewd.
Solark's been all right. I mean, he's scoring, so like you're noticing him more. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's not necessarily like, you know, some dominant presence, but I think he's played pretty well. And then, yeah, I haven't been too happy with Frederick. I think he's just, he can't keep up with the pace of the game, really, to me. One, in his skating speed, and then two, his play recognition. He just can't quite, he's not fast enough to make the reads that he needs to be at place X, you know, quick enough. And so he's just not playing great defensively, in my opinion. So I haven't been happy with Frederick, and Solark's been all right.
All right, I'll let Sky dive in before I say my piece on this.
I am very happy with Peter Solark. I've been one of his biggest, low-key one of his biggest supporters. High key. Because highest key, the highest key possible. Dogs are barking because of this key. He really should have made the team out of camp.
Agreed.
He really should have been a player that they should have taken a chance at. I don't know what they thought they were going to get out of all the other players that they've, you know, rotated through that role. But, you know, just going through Hockey Viz, you know, going through the 5-on-5 shots, you know, he's rarely, if ever, been below the bad before, below the bad line, which is the big red line through this diagonal graph. I'm not smart. I can't explain.
Fancy stats.
This is an audio medium. I'm trying to explain a visual.
Long story short,
he's always outshot his competition,
which is way. Yes, he has always outshot his competition. He has always looked very good, and when he scores, it, you know, he's scored some pretty impressive goals, in my opinion. And if he can just pace that, frankly, isn't going to look so impressive now because of how late he came into the season, but he just, you know, keeps at it, plays his game. I think he will be one of those people that we go, oh my gosh, how did they find this guy? Even though we all kind of knew this was where he should have been. I do agree that Frederick has been, I don't know if it's just him, but I think that third line in general, as much as he's looked fun from a, you know, a heart standpoint, from a eye test standpoint, where he's, you know, back checking like a mother and just, you know, playing his heart out, he does look slow, and more importantly, it doesn't look like he really has that much offensive punch. And on a line that's already having a lot of trouble scoring, he's not great, and I don't think he's what they need right now. And controversial take, and yes, I know that objectively speaking, the player that I would maybe sub in is far worse. But honestly, I get what JFK is doing better than I think Trent Frederick's doing, because I just don't think that his game plan is actually going to create any scoring chances.
Not been subtle, I guess, not like really intentionally, but I am not a big JFK believer. I haven't been, you know, ever since, you know, he sort of came into the pipeline or anything. I'm still not. That being said, I agree with you, Sky, that even though I don't think JFK brings much of anything to the table at this point in his career, he probably brings more than we've seen out of Frederick. And I say that like fully respectfully and acknowledging, you know, I even said this on Twitter, that my expectations for Frederick were basically non-existent. It was a thing where if they wanted to bring him up and he looked good, great. If he didn't, that's okay too, because he's a young kid and it's his first NHL minutes. Like I'm not here like, you know, crapping all over the kid. He's young. He'll progress. But right now he's not an NHL player. And I think to Sean's point, you know, he trails plays. There's nothing in particular that stands out that even looks adequate at the NHL level to me, other than, you know, his ability to beat the crap out of people, apparently, which was entertaining, I guess, but you know, that's not really what we need out of our third line center right now, as you know, fun as it was for some people. So I think that that experiment might be over sooner rather than later. It might be JFK that comes back, or it might be a trade acquisition for 3C or whoever, but he's not ready yet, and that's fine, but he's not there in my opinion.
It's fine.
On
Providence is there for a reason.
Exactly. Like, you know, it's his first full pro season, you know, he'll progress. I don't know what his ceiling is. I'm not even going to pretend to, we haven't seen enough of him. Whereas with JFK, I feel slightly more confident and, you know, making proclamations on that. But in him, we've seen him for like 5 games. It's not enough. On Solaric, I'm obviously a big Solaric guy, as is Sky, as are quite a few of us at Chowder. We've been sort of ranting and raving about him for probably a couple years at this point. But
he
has 4 points, 3 goals and 1 assist in the 7 games he's played. Again, all this is such a small sample size that it's dangerous to buy into it too much. But all the statistics look pretty good, even though he's, you know, very, very favorable offensive usage. You know, he's great possession numbers. He's producing at over 40 point, you know, per season pace. And granted, he's also getting to play alongside Krejci. Like, that's a big part of it. He's being used offensively. He would hope he would produce, but we've seen other players put in that role and they haven't. And so at a minimum, he's been better than what they've had. Whether or not he'll pan out to be anything special, I don't know. He's 23 and a half almost. So it's not like he's super young either. But I think if he's given the right role, he can be a legit, you know, I guess scoring winger. That might sound a little too much of a hot take, but I've liked what I've seen. You know, he uses his size pretty well. He does battle along the boards for however much that's worth in reality.
Sacrifices like a mother.
Yeah, I don't think he looks out of place, and I don't expect him to come up and, you know, score at a 30-goal pace or whatever. Like, just come up and be more than what we got at Donato or Bjork or, like, whoever. And I think he's done that so far, and that may wear off. Like, he did just go, I think, 3 games without scoring. But I don't think he looked bad in them. And, again, the eye test is flawed, all of that. I get it. But, like, there were games with, like, Donato in particular – who I was very high on coming into the Bruins and all that, but like there are games where like you either don't notice him at all in like a totally negative way, or he looks so bad out there that like it's hard to not notice him. And I don't think I've really noticed that much with Solaric so far. So 2 thumbs up, I guess, at least in terms of what I had expected from him so far. You know, happy he's doing pretty well. And then, you know, I lied. I had one more topic I have to rant about. I just have to get it off my chest. But we'll dive into the DeBrusk versus Heinen struggles. And this is something Sean and I have talked about quite a bit, just between he and I. But there seems to be this narrative-driven thing where, you know, Heinen is sort of a scapegoat and Heinen's not performing and all this. And he hasn't, obviously. He has like 13 points or whatever it is. And he obviously is a well-rounded player. I like him a lot, even when he's not scoring. I think he brings value to the team. But lost in all that is the fact that Jake DeBrusk really hasn't been better. And people are going to, like, you know, tear their headphones out in disgust at that hot take. But he really has not been better. And when you factor in that he's played exclusively on second line, you know, with better players than Heinen has, I sort of look at that almost as being worse. Like, he's put in that role and he's really not playing or not producing well. And I'm curious on your thoughts. I already sort of know Sean's, but I'll let him sort of reiterate here too, because I think we all really like DeBrusk and I think we all like Heinen too. But what I'm getting at here is there seems to be this double standard where DeBrusk is sort of not catching a lot of the flack that Heinen is absolutely catching. He obviously just sat out 2 games, and I don't know, it's an interesting like dichotomy to me that one is getting a pass more so than the other.
I mean, they're good at different things, right? So, like, Heinen isn't an offensive player. Like, that's – did you – yeah, you revealed your hidden –
I have not. No. But you can go, because by the time we release this, we'll be good.
Yeah. So, I mean, you posted them side by side, and that's a longer term. That's 730 days. But Heinen was – you know, had by far, like, the better results. But, you know, Heinen's, like, a – terrific defensive player, and almost all of his value comes from that. Like, he's just like, especially watch his stick next time you watch, like, he's terrific defensively, and he's not an offensive player, so it's not flashy. And yeah, especially when you're playing with you know, lower quality of teammates, you're going to drop in terms of production. But, I mean, he always tends to control play at least better than his teammates do, like when they're away from him. So, you know, Haydn's been successful. He's been good all year. He just hasn't put in, you know, the pucks. And then DeBrusk is more offensive, and clearly that hasn't come. But, I mean, part of that might be because he spent, like, significant time on his off wing. Mm-hmm. And then, like, last year, he also had Ryan Spooner there, which I know a lot of Bruins fans like to go after the fact now that Spooner is, like, no longer in the NHL. He's in the He's in the AHL. Yeah. Right. He's in Bakersfield.
Yes, he is now in the AHL.
I said that, but you know, like Spooner was never good defensively with the Bruins, and it showed. You can go on and on about that. Like, but he was always a good offensive player, and so you have two very good distributors to the puck playing with you, you're gonna look like a lot better than, you know, and produce a lot more points. And Rust hasn't had that. He's been put in a position where he's sort of had to drive play, and that hasn't worked terrific. It's been like a lot of low to high play, and he's in front of the net. He really plays within the system, and it's not the greatest system. I've heard about that before, but you know, he plays correctly within the system, and it costs him. And I think DeBrusk has a lot of talent and a bright future, but right now, like, it's just not working out too well.
That's the takeaway here is not that any of us here are being too critical or like hating on either of them. We like both players. I mean, it's hard not to like DeBrusk too. Like, you know, but I want to reiterate the point here is that like a lot of my rants are driven by this like misperception with fan and media that, you know, certain players escape criticism while other ones don't. Like, they both scored at a similar rate, you know, or produced at a similar rate last year. They're both good young players. Just, it's interesting to me that like we're so quick to scratch and jump all over Heinen and not DeBrusk. And I do agree. And like I said, Sean and I have talked about this sort of at length, you know, outside of the podcast, but like the offside usage with DeBrusk, I think like that experiment probably needs to end at this point. I'm sure he's willing to do it. You know, hockey players will do whatever the coach says normally, but he doesn't look comfortable to me. I don't know. Like, and if you got even close to what DeBrusk gave you last year, that would be huge. So I'm curious to see if that lasts or what Bruce will do with that. But my takeaway of this is to maybe look with a little more objective eye the next time you're slamming Heinen for not scoring. Because it's not just Heinen, it's been sort of up and down the roster and DeBrusk as well.
I mean, Heinen hasn't been scoring great, but that line as a rule this year has just been awful. Just as a unit, it's either been heavily policed, where Bruce will just take away their minutes at the drop of a hat if anyone does anything wrong. And, you know, a lot of the time, Heinen has also had players who aren't exactly great offensively or can't really handle things together. So I don't know what – I think the best theory on what happened to DeBrusk is that he's been playing his off wing, and that's been causing him some trouble, which I think if, you know, you start to trust Peter Cehlárik a little more, you might be able to switch him back because – you know, he's a pure winger. He can play either side. But with Heinen, I mean, he's exactly what Sean said. He's purely defense. He's a player who is best used probably in defensive contexts. And I'm curious to see if they, you know, maybe give it a shot later down the line. But I think this is, in my opinion, I think this is just rookie woes. I think they've been occasionally put in positions where they're not going to succeed. And that is part of, you know, going through your sophomore slumps is, you know, sometimes you are thrown into positions that the coach thinks you can handle and then you can't.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it happens. Absolutely. So, I mean, For all we know, Jake DeBrusk could heat up tonight, and that'd be the end of that. And Danton Heinen would get like a million years worth of penalty kill time, and they'd be unstoppable. It's the nature of the sport that sometimes people regress or bad luck happens. I think that DeBrusk is. Whenever I think that DeBrusk is starting to have a bad time, he turns it on, or he does something truly, like, almost borderline terrifying, where he manages to create a scoring play. And I go, well, there's your answer. He just needs to have those moments happen. And yeah, Sean brought it up here. He's been a very low to high player throughout the entire year. And I feel like that if he was given a little more creativity or at least a little more leeway, I bet you he'd probably do a lot better. So I say just put these guys in better positions to succeed and they'll do better.
Yeah, like I said, that I am. I'm sure you both are as well. We're all bullish on both of them long term. Like, I would hate to see either of them traded away for less than, you know, what their actual value is. But, you know, it is hard to distinguish how much is, like you said, sophomore struggle, how much is that they haven't had consistent line mates or haven't had good line mates or whatever. But like I said, I always find these sort of things really interesting, in that we as a fan base zoom in on one player and sort of blame them, and we don't focus on, you know, other potentially deserving players as well. My last rant I will save. I think we'll probably end up doing a deadline special episode before the deadline comes, maybe touching on some trades that have happened or trades we'd like to see. Cough, cough. Bruins should have traded for Nino. Cough. But I did. I can't help it. But like, we all know the David Backes deal was terrible, right? Like, the second it was signed, I was like, this is terrible. And I know other people obviously felt the same. Like, if you're even like intelligent and follow the sport, it should have been obvious that that was a bad deal. Like, and then we see that, you know, Don Sweeney was all in on trying to get Ilya Kovalchuk in the off season. And I'm sorry, I am just like dying laughing about that now, where he's getting this pass from the fan base when Kovalchuk has been a disaster for the Kings, is signed for two more years and has a no movement clause
in fairness, has anyone been a success on the Kings this year?
No, but
like, they have just been a general nightmare.
I don't know if you've looked at like his relative numbers or like his underlying, he is like abysmal. Like, I'm not exaggerating. He is awful. Like, you can look at the skater charts, you can look at Micah's stuff, you can look at any of it. He is like legitimately bad, and it's only going to get worse with age. Like, he's not young. And like, I don't understand how, you know, fans aren't legitimately angry about this. Like, the Backes deal has caused all sorts of issues for the Bruins from a cap standpoint, from being able to make trades, all of that. And we would have hoped that Sweeney would have learned from that. But instead, like 4 months ago, he was trying to sign Kovalchuk to a 2 or 3 year deal. Like, he didn't learn. He's doing the same thing over again. It's the Backes deal, but almost worse, because Backes is actually a better player right now than Kovalchuk has been. Like, I'm veering off into rant territory, I know that, but like, if you're a Bruins fan and you think Sweeney's doing a good job, I respect your opinion on that. Like, I'm not going to change your opinion, but I do wish you would look at this and say, like, maybe he shouldn't be swinging for the fences, because it looks more like Beleski, Backes, and Kovalchuk than Panarin and Stone or whoever.
Well, again, we don't know what this market looks like, so for all we know, and furthermore, Panarin has been, I think, been taken off the table entirely. I don't know to the extent of the injury that I had heard that he had. So
I think he's still available, I think, but whether or not they'll actually, but, you know, trade him, I don't know. But
like that, well, I mean, I'd be shocked if either him or Bobrovsky didn't leave the Blue Jackets. But, you know, this is a tough time to be a GM, because, you know, if you miss, you're going to really miss, and you're going to be stuck with the guy. It's going to be very difficult to move on from. It's going to be tough to move on from the mistakes you make.
Yeah.
So,
yep. that back is sort of.
Yeah, so you have to either really strike out or you have to hit a home run, or you have to have a player so useless and so underwhelming that it doesn't even matter the amount that you gave up for them.
I find a good way to not strike out is to not swing at 35-year-old players who haven't played in the NHL for half a decade. That's just my strategy. Well, everyone's different.
I mean, to be fair to Don Sweeney, he was not the only guy.
No, he wasn't.
There were plenty good teams that were willing to do that and probably hit the same mistakes.
Yeah, I actually went back and was looking at this earlier to see what the consensus was to make sure I was remembering correctly, and it was the Knights, the Sharks, the Bruins, and the Kings were the teams that were all heavily mentioned, and like shame on every one of them. Like, there was no way that Kovalchuk was going to be good enough to justify the risk that you would be taking on as a team. Even if you were paying him lesser money or, you know, a second year, which is what I believe Sweeney was trying to get Kovalchuk was for 2 years, not three, but like they really believed he was going to come in and be Kovalchuk from, you know, like 2009 Devils. Like, no,
we never knew. I mean, obviously the red flags of swinging at a 35-year-old is there, but who knows? Maybe he ends up in a system that's just all aggression all the time and he can handle that, but that's not the system that he ended up in. And so I'm not super surprised this happened, but I'm not going to say that this isn't something that you would be blindsided by.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel real strongly about this, that the fact that Sweeney was intent on getting Kovalchuk is a sign that he has not learned that much from his mistakes. Like, and again, I respect other people's opinions on this, but like in a vacuum, if you hadn't signed Backes, I'd probably be a lot more lenient towards that, because I understand, like, you think maybe he can still be an effective player and it's your championship window when you go for it. But it's the same argument, like, as the Nash thing. Like, no, but you did sign Backes and you did trade a first-round pick for Rick Nash and you did all these things, and, like, you have to live with it.
At the same time, if you didn't sign the Backes contract, which it feels like this is just all running back to maybe signing David Backes was a bad idea. Had you not signed him, probably be in a way better spot. You'd probably just be thinking about what you could use that cap space for so that you have more options.
Yeah.
Which I think is way more important.
Yeah, and you could have had Tavares maybe or whatever, but the point is, like, you did do that, and you're still trying to basically do the exact same thing over and expect a different result, essentially. Yeah. That's my take. Yeah, yep. And that's why, like, the fans, you know, in my mentions are all like, they need to make a big trade, and I'm like, I get it. I get where you're coming from as a fan. But as long as Don Sweeney is at the helm there, I would be a little hesitant about, you know, wishing that on for this team. Like I said, their big swings have been misses more often than they've been hits, you know, in his tenure. And people think I'm being unfair. I get that, whatever. Everyone has their take on Sweeney. I don't think he's bad at, you know, all around. He's done good things. But when it comes to his trades and his free agent signings, I'd be leery if I was a Bruins fan. But we've gone long here. Definitely a long episode. It's good to be back. Covered a lot of topics. If you aren't already, feel free to follow each of us. You can follow Sean at the Sean Ferris. You can follow me until you realize my Twitter is terrible at C Beswick. And you can follow Sky at Sky on Air, as well as, if you should already, but you can follow the main page at Cup of Chowder and, the podcast page at SB Unsupervised. As always, love your feedback, good, bad, in between. We're open to it. Appreciate you listening, and appreciate Sky and Sean for joining us.
Hey, it was fun.
Yeah, we try.
We can't wait to do it again.
Yeah, you brought the positivity. You held up your end of the bargain, and I think I brought the negativity. I think we did it.
Have the Bruins made a good trade in the last 3 years or 4 years, however long
it's
been?
What, you don't think Ronaldo for a third was a good trade?
No, but you said misses more than not, and I can't think of a win.
Yeah, no, I was trying to be nice, but
you can swing, you can swing at every pitch. You're just gonna get struck out at three.
I was thinking about this like earlier this afternoon. 2015-16, the third line, none of the players play in the NHL anymore. It was Pulaski, Spooner, and Jimmy Hayes.
This is not a big trade, but I think it was a good trade. I think as much as I like legitimately loved the player, the McQuaid trade was a good trade, I think. Like, not a big trade.
But that's not a big trade.
But like the Rick Nash trade, I will go to my legit deathbed yelling that that was a mistake.
I don't think it's going to be that bad.
I really didn't like the Nash trade. You guys already know that. Like, I'm looking at the list here.
I think when you look back on it, it's not going to be like terrible.
It depends on what they do this year, right? Because you can't trade, or you shouldn't trade a first again. Like, it's not like they have a great farm system either.
Definitely don't want to.
I think the Lucic trade was probably the last trade they made that was both big and good.
That's right. The two trades are no. I mean, I wasn't happy with the Dougie Hamilton trade, but like, you at least got the compensation. I wasn't happy when I saw that they were giving him 5.5 and Bruins wouldn't pay that.
Yeah, right? We.
I thought it was like, although any number that Hamilton would have got would have probably been worth it. But anywho, like, that wasn't terrible. And then you're also moving into like a wicked good draft, right? So like, you could have taken like Shabbat there, like blah blah blah. Like, you could have taken a good player there. But then the Miller, Colin Miller, Martin Jones. And a first round pick, and they turned Martin Jones into a first round pick.
And Corrali. So
you got a legit first round you got a legit first pair of defensemen in Colin Miller.
You gave up, but yes.
Yeah, gave him up during the
expansion draft, which they could have picked anything.
And you could have potentially got DeBrincat. And then you could potentially got, like Shabbat or like any other player that should have gone there at 15. And instead, like, they wasted it.
Yeah. I mean, that's like a full episode we could go through, not just Shirelli or not just Sweeney, but the Shirelli era too. And like, this was a pretty heated argument in our Slack chat not that long ago. I was arguing that Shirelli wasn't a good GM when he was here either. And that's like apparently a hot take, but he wasn't. And there's a lot of Sweeney. There's a lot of Shirelli and Sweeney too. And people are going to think that's a hot take too. I'm not saying they're the same. Sweeney is a better GM than Shirelli is, obviously. But they have a lot of the same characteristics and overvaluing depth players and that sort of stuff. So,
and there's been a constant too with Scott Bradley.
Yeah.
Everybody likes to talk about like how Scott Bradley like said like Tyler Seguin doesn't fit the system. Which, like, I get it, it's like a TV show. Like, don't put too much into that. Like, he's been a constant over, like, all of these terrible dealings of young players.
So is Neely.
Whether it was Sagan, Hamilton, Miller, whether it's not taking Barzal, Kyle Connor, Shabbat, whatever it is. Like, and that's what's supposed to be what he's, like, specializing in. Like, he's completely just destroyed these players, like these terrific.
We're losing listeners by the second here. We're just bringing up all this negative stuff here. Yeah, maybe someday we will. I mean, if I ever get to writing again, I'd love to just do like an exhaustive like history of Shirelli and Sweeney's moves, free agent and re-signing and stuff. It's just like, I get not everyone's gonna feel the same way as I do when it comes to Sweeney. I don't think he's a particularly good GM. I respect other people's opinions on that, but I think when it comes to trades, like I said, I just personally just be careful what you wish for a little bit, I guess, there. But now that we've thoroughly depressed the fan base with this wonderful episode, we'll wrap up for real. We'll be back in a couple weeks with a new episode before the trade deadline. Where I'll harp on them not trading for Nino a couple dozen more times. But I appreciate you both joining me.
It's always good. Always a pleasure.
All right. Thanks, listeners. Have a good night.